You know, every year when fire agencies are starting to prepare for fire season, which is now kind of a random idea in that we have fire season now all of the time, especially around here, and throughout the West. They always have sections devoted to predictive services, and predictive services often include drought indicators, precipitation forecasts, and then fire danger. What they expect fire activity to be like over a given set of months. And obviously, the further out you go, the harder it gets, but they have got it down pretty well, and they can estimate the cumulative impacts over time, especially as it relates to fire risk. And so tonight, have some slides that share with you. I'm gonna try to do the share screen bit here. And I think that is, does everybody see that?
Looking good.
Okay. All right.
And there will be a quiz on this, so pay close attention.
So the first slide is, as you can, is the precipitation as it has been. It is from January through March of this month of this year. And as you can see, California and Nevada have all experienced significant drought across these months. But as you move further east to Colorado, you can see the green, where we've had a good amount of precipitation. Obviously, that was not the case in late 2021. But as we all experienced January, February, and some of March, to be wet. And that's kind of reflected in this picture. So that is kind of setting us up for where we go from where we go into April, May, June, July, and August. So this is, I don't know if you've seen this. I think it was in an email that came out from the office. Seasonal drought outlook. This is April 1st through June 30th. And as you can see, we across the West and much of the Midwest, there's significant persistence of the drought that we've heard so much about over the last few years. But Boulder County in the Continental Divide has had a good amount of precipitation, snowpack, and that's reflected in the white area. So that's kind of setting us up in that much of Colorado is in drought and in significant drought. So we kind of look at the precipitation outlook. We have we have below normal and less than normal precipitation forecast for the next few months. April was exceptional. I think everybody can agree. Here in Colorado, especially in the Front Range, I think Denver received half an inch of rain across the entire month. We didn't really do much better in Boulder County. There were in Boulder County, there were 16 days of fire danger watches. We did not recover much from the moisture that fell just a few days ago. So this is kind of setting us up for the summer. We have a persistence of drought or in much of the state, and it growing into Boulder County. We have below normal or less than normal precipitation outlook over the next few months ahead of the monsoon. And this is the resulting fire potential. As we saw in April, we had a number of fires here in Boulder County. I think we had five or six, which is not too unusual, but it's still quite significant because of the winds that we've had. So that's April. Oh, sorry. This is May. Doesn't really change much, as you can guess. We're still dry. We still have much of the same type of weather that we had in April. So we get into June. There's the lessening of the risk. That's partially because of monsoon setting up early. As we get back into July, we have a lot more above normal fire potential. And we get into August, that continues to persist here in Colorado on the Eastern Plains, including Boulder County, as well as further north, and strangely up into the Rocky Mountains. Typically, South Dakota, upper Wyoming, and then Montana burn a little earlier than August. But this year, because of the weather patterns, there is a lot of talk about significant fires being up there and then down through Colorado. So that's kind of where, that's kind of what we're looking at in terms of what fire agencies have been looking at and talking about over the last few weeks. I'm gonna stop sharing screen. Is there any slide that someone would like me to go back to? Abby, can you tell me if anybody's raised a hand or no? Okay. So basically, we're gonna, the forecast for us is dry and with a significant fire potential like we've had for the last number of months, which is not where we want to be, but it's where everybody expects us to be in the coming months.
I have a question or two for you about that.
Yeah.
So, and I guess maybe before I even ask that, I'm going to ask everybody who's joined us to use the reactions down on your lower screen or turn on your camera and just raise your hand if that's easier. And I'm just curious how many of us live in the mountains. I'm kind of guessing most of us because we're in the program. So that's, I think, pretty much everyone. Sorry, the screen keeps sort of bopping around a little bit. So I guess my question, Brett, is this different than years past, or is this kind of just more of the same?
So that's a great question. So this is not much different than what we experienced in 21 and late into 20. So you'll remember the fire activity that we had in the county and the significance of the fire activity across the state. This is similar, highly similar. I think the difference though is that Boulder County didn't really enter drought until late summer last year, early fall, more like late August and September. This year it's starting out in a drought. So there is a lot more potential. And I don't know if anybody's been out hiking. I know I've been doing a good number of assessments at households, and up until the last bit of moisture that we had, I was very surprised at how crispy things were.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the finer fuels that really carry fire, as it did in Cowood, are already really dry. So I think.
Do you think that could turn around with some May rains, yeah, or is that not really in the forecast?
They don't, from what we've seen from the prescriptive services, they don't seem to think that we're going to get much precipitation across May and into June. The monsoon starts setting up late June, early July, and that would be the most significant source of rain that people have been talking about.
Cool. Well, let's stop for just a quick sec because I see four hands up, and I'm not sure if that's because we have four people with questions or if those are just four people who didn't take their hands down. So now there's just one, and it's somebody's phone, 303. Okay, I guess we didn't have any questions. I just didn't want anyone to have a question that we were not answering. And so just to remind folks, this is interactive, and we don't only have to talk about the forecast, but at the moment, I mean, I'm still interested in the topic. So I have another question or two, but Brett, you may have more to say, but if folks have questions, just go ahead and either type them in the chat or just raise your hand and I'll let you know you can unmute and ask your question. Anyhow.
I hear the feedback too. Let me drop off of this because I wonder if it's my computer. Abby, can you take it for just a minute? And let's see if I can't correct it.
Sure.
Okay. Just out of curiosity, is anybody wearing headphones?
We can actually see where the feedback is coming from. It's actually from the Wi-Fi partners. It's from your host feedback. So it's not you, Brett. You can, when you go to the screen where you can see everyone's screen, you can see whose screen is getting feedback. It's actually from the Wildfire Partners screen.
It's probably mine then.
It's from your screen. Yep.
It's just hard to have a conversation with muting and unmuting, but I'm going to try to mute when I'm not talking.
So one of the things that I'm hoping that we can all talk about, or if there's interest in talking about, is in this kind of environment, if the forecast is predicting an intensification of drought, less precipitation, what can we do in terms of mitigation, or what can we do in terms of limiting a fire's impact on our property and impacting our values at risk? Values at risk is the fire term for houses, barns, sheds, cars, all of that kind of stuff that you typically find in a fire environment. So, if people are interested, that would be a fun topic to explore, I think.
Well, and I will jump in and say that I think this is probably a really good time for those of us who, and I'll raise my hand and shame myself, who have some firewood still on their decks, to perhaps move that off of there for the summer, or find some kind of non-combustible container to put some wood in, which I need to do both of those two things.
You're not as good as I thought they were.
It's very common. And I think every assessment I've been to in the last 4 weeks have had firewood on the decks or on a landing somewhere near the house or up against the house.
Yeah, I would agree, Brett. I have had the same experience with seeing firewood around. And like I said, I'm guilty of it myself, but I do think we're probably done burning wood for the year. So but I actually like to keep a metal trash can full of wood on my back deck just for those kind of rainy, cold June days or May days when I might want to throw a few sticks in the stove.
Yeah, that's a really good kind of staging way of doing it. Having a non-combustible container like a corrugated steel box or something that is not going to really help support ignition in an environment where there's lots of other sources for it can be a really good thing, really good habit year round. In all honesty, especially as we see fire season stretching out more into colder months, having that staging could be really beneficial.
Yeah, absolutely. And, so here's a question for you, Brett. I mean, what do you think this says about our grasses and what we should be doing with that? Do you think they'll be growing slower, growing faster? Is it as important to keep them short when it's dry, when they're not maybe growing as quickly? Or what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think we've all been impressed with what a grass fire can do in the last few months. And I don't know if anybody has ever seen a fire out in Oklahoma or Kansas, but grass fires can put up plumes that go 30,000 feet. And when they get a head of steam behind them with winds, they can do, as we saw in the Marshall Fire, lots and lots of damage. So I'm a big advocate for keeping grasses short all the time. When you cut grasses, you're lowering the fire intensity and you're shortening the duration of which a fire can be burning towards your house. And that's only a win. Now, one of the factors for all of us as homeowners, in that first 20 feet beyond the non-combustible base to the house, or the surface around the house, you really want to try to get up the material cut, because when you just cut the grasses and don't rake it up, you're just basically changing the orientation of the fuels. You've not changed the fuel loading. And the fuel loading, again, I'm sorry for the fire term, is really the amount of combustible material in any one area. Like wood right. furniture on a wood deck next to wood siding. That's a lot of fuel. It's a heavy fuel loading that has a lot of potential. Grasses, as they mat down, just continually to build on top of each other. And by raking it, you not only aerate the soil a little bit, but you also remove that material in such a way that you've reduced the fire loading.
So, good answer. So we have a bunch of questions in the chat, Brett. So I think we should dig into those. The first question, I think I will take this one. And the question says, I have a pile of slash to be chipped. Will there be chipping done by anyone on old stage? And
you can have that, Abby.
Yeah, I'm gonna field this one, because I mean, even though my answer is actually I don't know, so I'm sorry, but so I think this is gonna come as a surprise to absolutely nobody to find out that our program is having some staffing challenges, as are so many other businesses. We were hoping, and maybe are still hoping, to have our chipping program, our curbside chipping for wildfire partners, like we did for the last few years. But we have had a hard time finding any qualified staff to hire. So we have reposted the jobs, and we're hoping to get people to apply and hire some folks. If we don't, we don't really have, I mean, we have a few thoughts on plans B and C, but so I guess the sort of long short answer is hang tight, and we will let you know within the next few weeks about the chipping program. But in the meantime, if you feel like, you know, I don't really want to wait a few weeks to find out, the Netherlands Sort Yard did open last week.
Yep, May 4th.
They also have been having staffing issues, unfortunately, up there. So two things about that. One is the Allens Park Sort Yard hasn't opened yet because they don't have staffing. And I don't think that there's been a date posted for Allens Park yet. And the second thing is that Netherland is now open, I think, Wednesday through Saturday instead of Wednesday through Sunday. So just bear that in mind. And then so if folks are going to Netherland or whatever, you can take slash to the Sort Yard Wednesday through Saturday. Western Disposal also has a new yard waste site that's, I think it's near the recycle center, sort of near Stasio. Like, it's not inside of the Western complex anymore. And I have not seen the new site, and I don't even know whether there's a small fee or not for dropping stuff off there. But if you live on Old Stage, that might be more convenient for you than going up to Netherland. So, Brett, do you have anything to add to that?
I think you were talking about asking if anybody on this call wants to apply or take part to support the chipping program.
Yeah, who wants to apply to be our chipping crew?
Maybe
Percy's bunnies have an interest in that position.
If you know of anybody, you know, it's a great job, especially for college students, you know, looking for a shorter time duration with some good potential income. It could be really quite good.
Yeah. And so, if someone is interested, go to the Boulder County, Google like Boulder County jobs. And I think that job is still posted till the end of the week. And now here's a question that I'm going to throw to you, Brett. What's the guidance on spreading chips out on the property?
Yeah, I saw that question. I think that's a great question. And, you know, this is the time to be asking or to really thinking about that. So obviously wood chips are used in a lot of locations for the purpose of moisture control, right? And one of those conundrums is that wood chips are basically chewed up trees, which you don't want necessarily at the base of your house or within the first 10 feet of your house. So If you're thinking about ways of, or, you know, planting in your beds, think about rock, think about trying to keep it as mineral soil. Wouldn't really suggest wood chips, especially within the first 10 feet. But if you are going to use wood chips, really kind of think about putting it out, knowing that wood chips do dry out. They're very, they're not a heavy piece of wood, so they don't retain moisture in a very long fashion. And so as we get warmer, as we get drier, they're also going to get drier and they're also going to become kindling. So just use some guidance about that first 10 feet, really try to keep it clean, keep it green. And I think that it's mean or lean as well. Green, lean, and mean. So that first 10 feet, really try to keep the wood chips out of it. But that's a great question. Very timely with everybody planting right now. Thank you for asking it. And that's a really good one.
And I am going to add a little bit to your answer, if that's okay. Because the actual guidance that we have on spreading wood chips is to keep them at 2 inches or below as far as like the height of them. Because first of all, I think when there's less mass, then they are more in contact with the earth. And so they'll break down more quickly, especially if you live at some of those higher elevation properties where you actually have a little more moisture. And then the second thing is that if for some reason you do have a surface fire, there's going to be less heat generated by a thinner layer of chips. And you know what, Brett, and everybody else too, for that matter, I read something very interesting the other day about wood chips, which is like not all wood mulch is created equal. So the wood chips that you get from grinding your trees and branches are less combustible or sort of take longer to catch fire and burn more slowly than the mulch that you go out and purchase in shredded bags from a hardware store. So I think if you're making choices about what to use, like say on your garden paths out, you know, in zone 2 or whatever, using those wood chips is a better choice than going out and purchasing shredded mulch.
So some of the thinking along those lines is say you cut a bunch of trees, you're chipping it up and you're going to broadcast the chips. As Abby pointed out, the depth of the chip really matters. The depth really, really matters. Because what happens when a surface fire or ground fire hits that, it slows down because of the material type, but it also sits there smoldering. And so it's prone to reignition. And so you want to be a little careful about the depth, as Abby pointed out. But if you have the opportunity to reduce the fuel loading on your property, get rid of the chips, in all honesty.
Absolutely. Good point. So we have another question here. And I know you are fully qualified to answer this one, Brett. How far should the firewood be from our house?
So 30 feet.
Thanks for the reminder.
Yeah, 30 feet is the guidance. One of the nuances to 30 feet is think about the way the fire patterns are in Boulder County. The two predominant fire patterns are west-east and then southwest to northeast. Hey, Abby, can you mute a minute? West to east and southwest to northeast. So if you're building a firewood pile or a firewood stack, you want to think about it in terms of on the east side of the house or on the north side of the house. That way, if a fire is coming through your property, your firewood pile doesn't increase the burn or contribute to greater ember production. By moving that, not only 30 feet from the house, but positioning it in a way that is not going to create more fire coming towards your house is always good advice. Remember, when you are building a firewood stack, you want stacks and not piles. Piles have a lot of surface areas, so they're more prone to ignition, and they tend to be more like a bonfire, where the stacks are a little harder to light. And so the more you can reduce the combustion in that way is also a really good trick. Did I answer that question, whoever asked?
Yeah, thank you. I asked it. Thank you very much. That's a great reminder. And I just realized we actually store a little wood inside our mud room. So that's probably a big no-no too.
No, actually, whenever you can store wood inside a garage or inside a house where it's enclosed and not exposed to the elements, it's actually a really good thing to do. So kudos.
So it's okay to store it inside.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Where are we? So the next question I see in the list is, where are we supposed to store grill propane? I'm assuming the containers, which is on our deck, and the spare. It's a great question. I will tell you, as a firefighter, I have tossed many, many propane tanks off decks as we've been doing structure protection. So obviously, if you can move those when you're evacuating or before you evacuate, that's a really good, helpful thing, because it is one less thing suppression resources have to do around your house to help protect it. You know, the spare, just like we were just talking about in terms of the firewood, storing it in a garage or storing it in an enclosed area would be good. If you have a shed that has decent fire mitigation around it, or has fire mitigation or hardening to the walls or the base of the structure, could be also a good place. You want to try to limit the exposure of the tanks. So if you think about if you have a deck that has a southwest or west kind of exposure, and you have a fire coming in that direction, you're going to have a lot of things landing on the deck, firebrands, embers, what have you. If they build up around the tank, it's going to be a lot like the propane tank you have outside your house. If there's enough heat to expand the gas, you could blow the tank, and those tanks are not as strong as your propane tank is, your big 100,000 gallon tank. And so those blow up much more easily. So storing them in a different spot is always good. Remember, removing them when you're evacuating is always good. Put them inside the house. But if you can store them elsewhere, it's always good. You know, having a deck, and Abby, I think you have said this as well, when you have a deck, if you have a grill on your deck, maybe position it more towards the railings instead of up against the siding. That way there's not as much heat exposure to the siding, or that things don't get stuck, embers or what have you, in between the grill and the siding, wood siding in particular. But positioning it further out by the guardrails is often a really good way to have a grill, have a propane grill in a safe way on a house.
And
does
I
that answer the question for that one?
I just want to add one thing about grills, which is you definitely want to turn your propane tank off when it's not in use, so that if, you know, there isn't that potential for those little bits of propane to be leaking out, and then that could basically cause ignition in a wildfire situation too. So even that way, if you're not home to turn it off or get rid of it, you'll have that peace of mind of not thinking that maybe there's a little bit of propane around your tank.
Yeah, that's a good thing. So can I address Diane, who has the firewood question in a wheelbarrow? So Diane, thank you for bringing this up. It's actually a very somewhat common thing to see when you're doing assessments, to have a wheelbarrow or something that can transport wood as it's needed. The one thing you want to think about is how often are you moving it when you're leaving the house to go grocery shopping? Or I'm assuming you would move it if you were going on vacation or being extended for a while away from your house for an extended period of time. The challenge with having firewood near a house, as we all know, is that if you're not there to move it, it's going to be a risk factor if there's a wildfire. So it's kind of, you're playing the odds as to what can happen while you're away. And informally, from the number of assessments that I've done in the Netherlands area, it seems like many people were away on vacation during cold spring. It's like one of the most common things that people say about the cold spring fire. Oh, I was on vacation. I was out of the country. I was somewhere else. So if you do something like that, having a wheelbarrow is a great idea because it definitely makes it mobile and more easily transported away. But you have to really be disciplined to think about it in terms of, I'm going to be away Saturday afternoon, I should move the firewood away. So Abby, do you want to add anything or have we got that one?
I think you've got that one, and maybe I will take Diane? The next one.
Did we answer your question, Diane?
You unmuted, but you're silent for some reason. She's good.
Okay. Very good.
So the next question from Mary Grace is asking, have you heard anything about reviving programs like Saws and Slaws? And she had Sugarloaf in parentheses, which I take to mean that she's specifically interested in that area. And the short answer to that is no. I know that the Saws and Slaws in Coal Creek Canyon is still very active. And I think that what it really takes for reviving or starting a program like Saws and Slaws, which is a community-based program, is that community spark plug. So if you are that person, Mary Grace, I imagine that the folks over in Coal Creek Canyon would be delighted to talk with you about sort of their process and all of that. But and it may be that something's going on that I don't know about, because there's lots that goes on that I don't know about in this world. But I personally have not heard anything about a Saws and Slaws in Sugarloaf. Brett, have you heard anything about that?
No, I knew Cesar, who started Saws and Slaws, and he talked to me about the organizational challenges to it and the liability that it brought. So there's some challenges to doing it, unfortunately. But I will tell you, it is a fantastic way of doing mitigation across properties and bringing people together. I know that a lot of firefighters will get their buddies to come over and cut, and they'll cook steaks and drink beer afterwards. Not beer while they're cutting, hopefully, but they tend to do something like the Saws and Slaws. But I haven't heard anything outside of Coal Creek County. Can I take Shelley's question? So Shelley, what does UNAVCO stand for?
It's UNAVCO. And once upon a time, it had each letter meant something about satellite systems.
Oh.
I'm not going to share that because
okay.
Now
it's okay, that's fair. Sorry to call you out. So to answer your question, best practice is a minimum of 3 feet. Okay. We say 3 to 5 often to kind of give a range. I think, again, the firefighter in me speaks to the more you have, the better off it is because you stop a fire further away. 3 feet is the minimum. It's very effective. It can be either just mineral soil or vegetation-free soil, or vegetation-free soil with landscape fabric and rock on top of it. If you put rock in the landscape fabric, really suggest edging it with tin or rock or brick or something, because it really actually does, and Abby, I think you can back me up on this, it really does have an impact in terms of what grows into it, rather than just a soft barrier of rock or whatever. But 3 feet is the minimum for compliance in the program.
Yes, and I will say I am a very reluctant fan of the 3 foot non-combustible barrier, and I think Brett knows this because he fire fought at my house during the 4 mile fire, and that fire did burn right up to our gravel border on the west side of our house, and I have to say we were very unhappy about having to put that in. We were winding down our construction project. We were living in somebody's basement, and the county was like, oh yeah, well, you can't move in until you put in this non-combustible border, but it definitely did stop the fire. And it's extremely easy to weed 20 years later. I can do that around my entire house in 20 minutes just because the stuff just like comes right out because of the weed barrier. So I am kind of a proponent of it. I'm an enthusiastic proponent of it for sure. And so, if I can just add a little bit to what Brett said, the standard about the 3 to 5 feet, like 5 feet is probably better than 3 feet when the fire behavior is extreme or in certain, like, especially at the corners of homes, the science shows that 5 feet can add a lot more protection just because of, and Brett, you can probably give more details about this, but the way fire behaves, it's just sort of more concentrated at the corners or something. And also if you are on a steep slope, you might want to extend that non-combustible border out a little bit further. Or if you have a lot of vegetation right at the edge of it, again, you could either extend or you could just remove some of the vegetation and thin it out a little bit. But I guess I kind of speculate that in the future, that standard might grow from 3 feet to 5 feet, but just because our fire behavior is becoming more extreme. I don't know if you share that thought or not.
Yeah, no, more ember production, more. So remember, the barriers, the 3 to 5 or 3 to 5 or more foot barriers are really there for two reasons. One, embers hit the side of the house. They don't penetrate into the siding because it's a flush surface. They fall on a non-combustible surface and they get blown up against an exposed foundation, right? That's the ideal situation, in that it's non-combustible in that barrier and non-combustible at the base of the house. So what do embers do at that situation? They go out, right? Then if you're working the first 30 feet of your house in such a way that you're opening it up, you're more likely to have grasses. And those grasses are prone to spot fires or catching fire in such a way that it may bring fire to the house. By trimming the grasses, not only, as I said earlier, you're shortening the duration, lowering the intensity, but that barrier is going to keep a fire further away from access to the siding. It is a very unfortunate story out of the Four Mile Canyon fire that we lost a lot of homes to creeping ground fire. That's why that 3 to 5 foot barrier is something that's really, really important. And not having vegetation like junipers or pines or other kind of things in that just make it even more effective. That was what I think one of the challenges in the Marshall fire, especially when it got into the more suburban areas. Lots of flammable vegetation at the base of houses because that's how they've typically landscaped things. So 3 feet is the very is the minimum.
Right. But to answer the actual question, 3 feet is the standard for wildfire partners. So if that's what you have, you will pass your inspection with us. And I'm gonna move on just because we still have more questions. And you know, believe it or not, the time is flying by. So here's one that says, can you recommend fireproof material to use when rebuilding an old deck? And I will start that one off and then I'll bop it over to you, Brett, because there is a document that the county has about ignition resistant materials. And I certainly cannot quote what it says, but it basically references some flame spread standards that have to do with different ratings. So basically wood is not a very fire resilient material. And then there are the composite products that you can use if you want those kinds of boards like wood, but that are not wood. And those actually come in various levels of fire resistance. So not all of them are particularly more fire resistant than wood, but some of them are. So if you're going to, you know, like a lumber store or a hardware store or decking materials store looking for a product that is going to be fire resistant to the level of like a 1-hour fire rating, I would suggest go to the Boulder County website and Google ignition resistant materials and leaf through that handout and find the language. And they will, somebody at the store will be able to match that up with the products that they carry. And they'll be able to tell you this material fits that standard, this one does not. So that's the composites. And the more plastic content basically that's in the composite, the more fire resistant it is considered to be. But there are other materials that people can use too. So Brett, what else do you think people could do?
So there are natural hardwoods like ipê, is a Brazilian hardwood. Tigerwood is another one that people have used. There's a wood out of South Africa that I'm forgetting the name of all of a sudden. But there are natural hardwoods that have ignition resistant aspect to them. Everything burns though. It's buying time, and that time is what's important. But ipê, Tigerwood, I recognize this is a county call. Trex, I'm not advertising Trex in any way, shape, or form, is often considered one of the better ones, but it's also one of the most significantly expensive type of decking materials. But it depends on the look you want to go. There are different types of wood out there. Abby's suggestion about searching ignition resistant decking, you're going to pull up a lot of different things on how to do it. One of the things I think is really important when someone is looking at adding, can you mute Abby? Sorry. One of the things that is really important when you're installing a deck that has a ignition resistance or composite kind of nature to it is that flashing. You've probably in your assessments had conversations about that L-shaped flashing in the junction of the siding to the decking and the importance of that for ember heat transfer and all of that. So when you're putting in a composite deck, what you really want to do is have just that vertical surface of flashing, about 2 to 3 inches high up above the deck line of the deck boards, but below whatever siding you have. And why that's important is you can't drill into a composite deck, a hardwood, tracks or whatever material that is, you can't drill into it without really impacting the integrity of the material. So when you're installing that kind of a deck, you really want that flashing at that last board underneath the siding, underneath the bottom piece of that siding, not covered by the siding. Seen that more and more lately for some reason. You want that flashing. And so what you've basically done is created that L-shaped non-combustible surface with the non-combustible or ignition resistant decking, and then the tin or whatever flashing material you're using below the siding. And that's an important thing. A lot of people who install decks professionally or composite decks professionally have been really doing that, and as consumers or customers of theirs, it's something you want to bring up in what conversations you're having with them as you plan out the deck, in addition to the board type.
And if I can just jump in here too, there are other materials that people have been using. So you can do metal boards for your deck, and there are also sort of some concrete products that folks use on their deck surfaces.
I've seen tile.
And then there's also, if you have a deck sort of close to grade, consider just eliminating the deck and putting a few steps down and then creating a hardscape patio instead. So on that note, I'm going to move on to the next question. Do you have any influence on upping the penalty fees for campers who light fires? Or even better, would be a significant county campaign about this. We see campers all over Magnolia and have made so many calls to the sheriff. People just do what they want, and I think we need to significantly raise awareness. I would say that we do not have any influence on penalties and fines. And my heart goes out to everybody. I hear this from Magnolia. I hear it from Netherland. I hear it from Sugarloaf. I hear it from Allen's Park. And then, of course, it happens down closer to the city of Boulder as well. So, yeah, I mean, educate is good. And I know folks sometimes, you know, I know there are certain like neighborhood mountain bike patrols where people ride around. And if you feel comfortable talking to folks and just educating them yourselves, that's great. Unfortunately, between the sheriff's department and the Forest Service, there are lots and lots and lots of citizens in this county and lots of acreage and very few employees working at these jobs. So I think we could use more staffing for sure, but I don't think that's gonna happen in the near future, to my knowledge. Brett, do you have anything you want to add to that one?
You know, there's always been this idea out there of trying to work with the Forest Service or whoever owns the campsite to mitigate it, to reduce the combustibles near where fire pits are, or to try to reduce the overall, you know, possibility of a fire being started. But it's a really hard topic. And, you know, to Abby's point, I've heard it many, many times. And it gets, there's a lot of strong feelings about it. And it's a really hard question of what can be done.
Okay. All right. Well, we are kind of getting towards the end. And I want to just quickly, I'm going to skip this question and come back to it. And just, there's a little bit of discussion here about decking material. So Rick put in autoclaved aerated concrete as a material that I think could be used on a deck. There's a link in the chat to the county's ignition resistant materials if anyone wants to access that. And there's a question that says patios, is concrete an option? Absolutely, you can have poured concrete. You can even have it textured or colored or whatever. And then I'm gonna bop back up to this question. It says, I'm wondering what can be done about people on the road stopping and taking pictures or watching the fire. During the Cowwood fire, we had trouble getting out of the neighborhood because there seemed to be so many people on the side of the road making videos and taking pictures. And wow, I really have nothing to say about that. I feel your pain. I understand how frustrating that probably is. And I know I was actually happened to be hiking on the trail that caught fire during the NCAR fire and noticed how trafficy it was and hard it was to leave the Table Mesa area because so many folks were evacuating. So the looky-loos definitely don't help. But I don't think there's any law against it as long as they're pulled off the roadway. So Brett, you might have something to say.
The only people who can close a road are the police. And I mean, a fire truck can get in the way and cause traffic problems, but the police are the only ones who can close roads, state patrol or whatever. And so, you know, law enforcement is so focused on evacuations, which is one of the things that they do really well, or can do really well. And so it's the attention, it's the number of resources versus what has to be attended to. And that's usually the thing. So closing a road further out obviously prevents people from doing that. But again, it's really it's law enforcement's role to close the road.
Great. So we have a little more in the chat and I have to read it because it totally cracked me up. And there is a question in here too, but Ken wrote, what about pea gravel on the house, pea gravel on the joint between the deck and the house? And Rick hilariously wrote back, if you pee on the gravel, that will definitely help stop the fire, but keep an eye on that joint. So in all seriousness, Brett, what do you think about putting pea gravel?
Why do I get this one?
Yeah.
I'm trying to picture that, to be honest. So we have a deck. What's the deck made out of? I suppose it doesn't matter. We have a deck, then we have pea gravel. And then the house is above the pea gravel, against the pea gravel. Is it like the first 3 feet around the house? But this time it's between the deck and the house. I'm having a hard time. I'm
envisioning this a little
bit. I like Rick's response though.
Well, what I'm envisioning is that they were talking about that space that where, you know, the wall of the house and the deck come together and there's that little spot there. And
yeah, but if it's an elevated deck, how would gravel stay there?
Well, it would probably get stuck in the flashing that's underneath the boards. But what I would suggest is using caulk if instead of gravel in a spot like that, if I'm envisioning the question correctly. And Ken, if you want to unmute and clarify it, you're certainly more than welcome to.
So one of the, you know, when you look at a deck, the spacing between boards can often be advantageous if it allows things to fall through. Sometimes there's a half an inch to an inch spacing between the final board and the siding itself. That can be really quite good because everything will drop down. Now, what's underneath the deck becomes of significance, but that space, depending on the size of that space, can be helpful in terms of not allowing things to accumulate against the siding.
I was talking about the junction there, which will be like, you know, a couple of inches on the deck and a couple of inches on the house siding, because we were told we had the wildfire mitigation a year or two ago, and they suggested taking the junipers out in front of the house, but also to do the like a concrete flashing. And nobody we could find was willing to do that. And I'm sure it's going to be pretty expensive. And I was just thinking about maybe the pea gravel being a barrier to igniting the deck and the house in terms of, if we had a fire.
I have to apologize. I've not actually heard of concrete flashing. I'm not sure what that's in reference to. Obviously, I haven't seen the report, and I don't believe I did the assessment. But typically, when people put flashing in that junction, it's a tin flashing. I've seen copper. I've seen other types of material like stone. But usually, that's an architectural feature that they want to have. Abby, have you heard of concrete flashing?
Well, I wonder if what they were talking about was like a fiber cement board screwed over the fascia instead of using metal flashing, it's an alternative or something.
The deck was rebuilt after the flood in 2013. And the house was from 1976. So whatever the deck had as far as flashing, I don't know. But I was just thinking about pea gravel as a possible deterrent.
Yeah, I don't know that I would recommend the pea gravel only because gravel or rock in general, things, sort of imagine like a old style sort of ash can where you could put your cigarette butts out into, like things kind of get stuck in it and don't fly out again. So I would just be afraid that you would end up trapping materials and then you'd have a non-combustible surface on the ground, but then you'd still have that combustible surface on the siding side. So I think an L-shaped flashing or maybe a fiber cement board, trim board would be a better alternative. If you want to get some visuals on this, if you go to the Wildfire Partners website, we have a photo gallery, and I think there are some pretty good pictures of deck flashing that homeowners installed themselves. So you can take a look there. And if you still have questions, you can call our phone number and talk to one of our staff and probably get a little bit of advice about how to go about installing that. So everybody, it is 8:01, and thank you all so much for sticking out the hour, and it's been a lot of fun. We hope to see you back next month. Same bat time, same bat channel, second Tuesday of the month next month. And Brett, it's been fun doing this together. So
I agree. It's been enjoyable.
Yeah.
Thank you, everybody, for taking your time tonight. It's great to have everybody be a part of this.
Absolutely. And bring your questions next month, or you can email them. And there were some email questions we didn't get to, so we have plenty to talk about at another time.
Yeah. Thank you, everyone.